Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. In December, because it marked 8 years after passage of the Land Claims Act, we focused several programs on the problems of village corporations and the possible formation of a statewide village corporation association as considered at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in November. We covered the subject from just about every perspective, except from the quarter which has consistently shown concern for the villages, the Alaska Native Foundation. Roger Lang is the president of ANF. He was chairman of a meeting of village corporation presidents, which met prior to the convention, and he has offered AFN's assistance to help set up a steering committee in its first statewide meeting. He listened to what the village leaders were saying and offers this assessment.
Basically, what they wanted to form or determine for themselves was what type of organization they could structure that would be a response mechanism for village problems. It's a large gap in the Native movement in Alaska. Basically, village corporations have been the kind of stepchild of the Claims Act. Not by design, I don't think, but simply by the press of time. For instance, in the Claims Act, it was required that severe deadlines, be imposed by law on three areas. One was organization. You had a certain amount of time to get organized as a corporation. Secondly, you had a certain amount of time to enroll. And thirdly, you had a certain amount of time to select lands. And that, in total, took, since the 8 years, about 3 years away from quote, the corporate life of Native organizations. And following that, of course, we got into statewide battles about easements, about transfer of lands, about transportation corridors, about coast and stream and lake management. We've mainly had to battle simply to get entitlements. The result was that there also is, by law, separate organizations. There are region corporations, and there are village corporations with separate organizations, separate boards of directors, separate everything, separate land entitlements. And the difficulty is putting all of that into a prioritized system so that the response mechanism of needs is met by everybody. And till now, it has never happened at the village level. And what they did by resolution was to appoint the steering committee from each of the regions represented so that they could determine for themselves what type of organization they need.
The formation of a steering committee was one result of the village president's meeting. It was not the main reason why the village leaders met.
Well, that wasn't the purpose of calling the village presidents together. The purpose was to attempt to identify problems that they saw as necessary to form something. We, as the foundation, we have done a survey of certain numbers of villages that we work with, and they have separated the categories where they need help into three areas. First, of course, is lands. They want to keep their land. They want to do economic development. They want to do resource development. They want to do land planning, and they need help. Secondly is finances, and in finances, they need everything depending on where the village is, and the survey says in finances, there's a need for help in everything from simple bookkeeping to feasibility studies, market studies, depending on the size of the village, where it's at, and what it's doing. And then finally, they need legal help. They want to be legal while they function as corporate entity. And the difficulty is that technical assistance to village corporations has to be a black and white proposition. It can't be the gray area that most Native organizations function, simply because each of these corporate structures called villages, the boards of directors of these villages, have by law some functions that are held unto themselves. One is a financial responsibility to the people that they represent. That means that, hey, eventually the director has to make up the mind. Secondly, there's a matter of confidentiality. As you conduct business, you need not broadcast to the world what you're doing. Otherwise, the cost of doing business goes up. And those, plus the separate organization, plus the fact that there is no way to represent villages, are areas that we see that something needs to be done. There's a great future in the retention of lands. That's the secret to everything. And there is a great future in the talent that lies in villages yet undiscovered. And
is this neglect been?
It's not neglect.
Is it just not?
Nobody ever did, and that's not neglect. But certain things are making this come to the forefront. One of which is that, hey, we're about halfway through with the Alaska Native Fund payments. And when that dries up, what the hell do you do next? You know, and that, plus the fact that some regions are merging, others are looking at joint ventures, new thinking has come out at a village level, all leads to the fact that something needs to be planned so that others know what certain villages are doing.
It will take a lot of time and effort before a mechanism is set up so that villages can exchange information about each other through any sort of a new organization.
The simple fact is that I don't know of anything statewide that's been put together in less than a year. And I've been a member and on the board and functioning in AFN when it transferred from an association to AFN Inc. And I've been around and assisted in the human resource side of AFN, trying to find its own niche and trying to develop areas where they want it to be represented, heard, and recognized. And they found their own niche by amending AFN's constitution. And I frankly don't see anything that will block that except a lot of hard work. Takes work. First, you have to identify why you want to organize. Secondly, you have to know what you want. And thirdly, you got to be fairly united. Otherwise, somebody's going to peel you off.
Even the strongest, most unified of Native organizations are subject to being peeled off by competing interests. And unity is extremely difficult when there are so many cultural, political, and economic differences among Natives in Alaska. But the desire for villages to unify and organize exists. It's come up several times before. And this latest attempt may be due in part to a growing sense of urgency as 1991, the time when the corporations are on their own, looms closer.
Yeah, there's urgency. But there's also a recognition factor, okay? We need to get somebody in the federal government to recognize that Congress created these things. It must have been serious when they did that. And we've got to get that same recognition at the state level. Yeah. It is urgent in that fashion. And but we suffer both by what makes us good as we attempt to organize. Basically, what makes us good is that we represent everything from Nooksit in the north to Saxman in the south. And when you throw the Pribilofs, and when you throw a whole bunch of things in, the what people call the benefit of size when it comes to organization is very difficult to put together, especially when you want to represent 214 different types of organization. But I think it can be done.
It can be done, perhaps, on a regional basis. The village presidents were very concerned that the new association be as democratic as possible, and that meant going back to the regions for grassroots support.
Yeah, and the regional representation is very good because while the problems might be similar in Alaska for village corporations, no matter where they are, the solutions are different depending on regional consideration. And they aren't a politics situation of who the regional corporation is. The politics situation is what are the avenues of escape for village corporations where they are geographically. And we find very little. Very few villages can walk down the street, talk to an accountant, a lawyer, or anything else. So, yeah, it is a regional consideration, but only for solution solving and representation, and not as a uniqueness of problems.
There are other organizations working on village problems on regional and statewide levels. There is ANF's own Village Management Assistant Program. In the Southeast, there is a for-profit consulting firm set up to assist villages there, and the Interior Village Association has been working with villages in the Doyon region and has recently offered its services statewide. Does it make sense to tie these existing groups together in some way?
Well, I'll be very honest with you. The profit corporation in Southeast that helped villages was under contract to VMA, and so was IVA. They're not strangers to us. Any way we can work with any organization that helps villages, that's what we have to do. We can't do it on our own. Neither can IVA, neither can CATSEC and Associates in Southeast. Everything that has happened in that area happened because we all cooperated. And after that, I can't find anything that helps villages. I can't find a federal program, can't find a state program, and I'm trying to create a philanthropic program. I'm trying to tie an educational package so that benefits will be lasting in social studies for villages, our rural schools, excuse me. I'm trying to, deep in my head, there's a concept that in Alaska, because of the cultural richness that we have of different tribal entities, different cultures and traditions, that basically we need an Alaska Native Cultural Institute to tackle a myriad of problems. Not all our problems are corporate. A lot of our problems are that we can't just preserve language and culture. You have to enrich it. Otherwise, it's going to just be a historical fact that's going to show up in books. We have to create poets, songwriters. We have to create curriculum. We have to do a whole bunch of stuff. So our problems aren't all that simple. The whole Native world needs to look at itself very carefully.
Now we're on a subject that makes Roger Lang's eyes shine, and we'll discuss concepts of cultural education with him in the next program with Roger Lang, president of the Alaska Native Foundation. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook Patterns, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller, and singing one of their national songs are approximately 45 Greenlanders who visited Alaska last fall. They were in a group of student teachers led by Ingemar Egede of the Teachers Training College in Nuuk, Greenland. The teachers reflected their country's mixed population of Inuit, Eskimos, and Danes. They spoke both languages as well as English. The student teachers travel outside their island homeland every year to broaden their knowledge of other cultures and other educational systems. Roger Lang, president of the Alaska Native Foundation, does much the same thing when he visits other circumpolar countries.
I meet once a year with Greenlanders, Samis, Canadians, Norwegians, Danes, Swedes, Finnish people. We get together once a year about education, and the result is I get to take a look at other cultures and other systems, and I find us strangely lacking in that area. Other countries in the world don't look at linguistic or cultural or traditional differences as problems. They look at them as a good part of their life and that worthy of doing something about. You know. We have got a lot to learn yet.
For instance?
They have this strange concept that you ought to educate a student best to fit the society that surrounds him. Frankly, they don't give a hoot about turning out a C student according to the California Achievement Test or anything else like that. They give a hoot. Because when they do that, there's about four different types of school systems in Greenland alone. They have folk schools, they have regular schools, they determine a teacher's, Ingemar runs a teacher's institute. They use a basic home language as a language that the student will be taught in. And what they do there is that they don't sacrifice quality, which is the key word, I guess, for any time we talk about whether we should teach natives native language. It's implied that in order to do that, we lose a quality of education. And the world says that's not true, except for us. When I go to Greenland or Denmark or Norway and meet with the Samis, or Canada and the Inuit Cultural Institute in Frobisher Bay, when you go there and talk to students, I'm a dummy. I can only speak English. I can't speak Danish or Inuit. When I go there, I speak English, and I find that students that are educated in their system are not only bilingual, they don't only know their home language, which is whatever the native language is, or their national language, they know English too. They're trilingual, or whatever you call it when you can speak four or five languages. And to me, that is a great dream of even the American system, except that ours needs to be French or Spanish or Latin, and now Tlingit or Inupiat or Yupik. And I think that when a home language, which happens to be Alaskan native language, is taught in a system, it shouldn't be taught as a foreign language. Maybe English ought to be taught as a foreign language. They don't sacrifice either what they teach as a subject, and in fact they tell me that chemistry, algebra, all this stuff that we think is very holy and can only be taught in English, was probably built in some other language and is very easily translated into theirs. So that those types of things that they do for individual students, which to me is very important, is what I think best exemplifies education. First, they demonstrate a care for the student. Secondly, they make him comfortable at home. Third, they give him a pride in what he is. And fourth, for communicative skills, they are better because of that system than anything I've seen demonstrated anywhere in the world. And the Samis have a cultural institute. The Greenlandic people have four or five school systems that fit students, including teachers. They don't just do it for students. They do it for teachers, they do it for administrators, and they do it in curriculum development. They cover the whole gamut of education. And they're serious about it. The Swedish countries, who only have occasional Sami visitors, think that Alaska is very exciting because we have many traditions, many cultures, many languages, and they only have one. They would kind of like to get in our act. You know? It's really funny to travel around and find a concept of education that thinks Alaska is exciting.
Alaska may be exciting because it's an educational frontier, but it is also tied to a tradition of American public schools which ignore or actively try to blend cultural differences. How do you turn the system around to the idea that a mix of cultures and languages is an asset to education?
How do you do it? Well, first you identify a problem, okay? We have the basis for doing things right in Alaska. The legislature has said when there are 8 students, you will teach language, you will teach culture, you will do that stuff. But what they haven't done is devise a system to make it meaningful both to the teacher and the student. When we created 21 school districts, in 1 year, no state ever did that in America. When we did that, we spent a lot of time fighting over the right of school boards to determine the education at a regional level. We also fought very hard to build schools, physical buildings. So we have the organism, which is the school board. We have the facility, which is the building. Now it's time to get on to what the hell are we going to do once we do that. And it's necessary to look at a total system. I don't want to disrupt a system. That's folly. I can't do that, nor can the governor, nor can the legislature. What I want to do is for the system now to take a look at itself as it relates to the individual student. And when you do that, it fits Diamond, it fits Point Hope, it fits Sexsmith. Eventually, it might even fit the University of Alaska. I'm not certain about that. But the fact is that if that happens, then, hey, 9/10 your battle is over. I don't know how to do it. I can interest a lot of people in what I'm talking about. I can interest the Kendall Foundation in Cambridge, near Boston, about what I'm talking about, or the Hazen Foundation outside of New York City. So when those people that are looking at this type of problem are interested, generally the mechanics, which basically come down to dollars, can be put together so that you sell a product and a concept without disrupting the system. I told you basically Canada, Greenland, and the other circumpolar countries do the same thing without sacrificing quality. And I mean that. And I think it can be done in Alaska without either sacrificing the system or the quality. We simply ought to add to it one more step.
But such steps are not made lightly, and systems often do not change easily. There are teachers, principals, administrators, and superintendents of school districts who have a vested interest in preserving the system. Should they be worried about what's being said here?
Oh, I don't think so. Part of the problem that we created when we created 21 school districts, for instance, was the fact that they were brand new entities with a lot of unknowns entered into. And the trauma of that was resulted in an evaluation very quickly of rural schools. Before they even ran a system from grade 9 through 12, there already were evaluation processes going into place. Before they developed a simple curriculum to meet their own needs, evaluations were being made on systems which were just in effect lifted from other areas and placed out there. The result is that the scheme of delivery of education in rural Alaska has emphasized certain problems which are not related to education, okay, even though they provide it. The school building, the administration of budgets, those whole things. And in order to meet that, we have scheduled, and we'll have our first one in January, a series of academies for superintendents. And the first leader of the first academy. And we're doing this in cooperation with the Department of Education and the University of Alaska and the superintendent's organization itself. The first leader of that academy will be Paul Ildesacker from the Harvard University School of Education, one of the most innovative thinkers in the world. And his topic is very good as he looks at the superintendent as, quote, the educational leader in the education system in Alaska. And I think that that's not a great fear. I think that's why they got there in the first place. We just created certain other problems for them, which have become very important in the near past. And we would kind of like to say to the good gentleman, hey, we can help you there if you'll assume your other duties. You know. Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because Alaska does things in quantum leaps. how we build the world's biggest pipeline, we create 21 school districts. You know, we do a whole thing in big fashion. And I think we have time now to reflect partly on the educational system in the state and maybe do things right instead of big.
Doing things right instead of big, said with a smile, which broadens as Roger Lang continues.
Education's been my hobby for about, I think, 15 years now. I can't remember.
I don't know if you can call it a
hobby. Oh, it is my hobby. I'm the most uneducated person you're ever going to meet. I've only gone through high school. I did that. I've taught college. I've never been to college. But I have taught a course in Sheldon Jackson called Native Involvement in Politics, and had a lot of fun teaching. I think basically at heart, I envision myself as a teacher rather than whatever other people call me. And in order to do that, you have to be able to evaluate systems. You have to be able to evaluate individuals. And you have to give people their head at what they do best. And I don't find a single teacher that's worth a hoot, or a school administrator that's worth a dime, or a school board that really, when you really find out why they're there, it comes down to the need to help individual students educate themselves. Partly we lose that in implementing our system, and I think we can put some emphasis back. I'm not sure whether the politicians are ready to do that, because the trauma of change is something that each individual has to weigh on himself. And if I really wanted to scare everybody, I would guarantee that there's going to be a change. And I guarantee you then everybody from the janitor to the superintendent in schools would be scared. But unless that change is initiated, endorsed, and conceived in a system in which there's total involvement of teachers, janitors, and superintendents, then I don't think we're talking about anything that's so traumatic.
Like you said at the beginning, education in Alaska could be exciting. You've been listening to Roger Lang, president of the Alaska Native Foundation. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been Chinook Patterns, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.